It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strangechamps. We all know we're going to die. Most of us have no idea what that'll be like, but there are a few people who do.
Hey there.
Hey.
People who actually started the process of dying and then came back.
Sebastian, it is so great to meet you.
Thank you.
Like Sebastian Junger, what happened to him began like this.
I'm a former war reporter. I gave that up years ago. And I started a family. And I was living at the end of a dead-end dirt road, deep in the woods, in a rural part of Massachusetts, on Cape Cod specifically, a property with no cell phone coverage. The landlines would go out when it rained. It was paradise, in other words. We had two little girls, who at the time were 3 years old and 6 months old. In June of 2020, in this remote place, I was woken at dawn by an absolutely terrifying dream. You know, I should say right now, right up front, I'm an atheist. I'm not mystical. I'm not woo-woo. I'm a relentless rationalist, right? Or like to think so. So that's the context for this dream. I dreamt that I was dead. Not that I was dying, not that something was happening, that I was already dead and that I was a spirit and I didn't know it. And I was trying to communicate with my family, with Barbara and our two little girls who were crying and inconsolable. And I was trying to signal to them, it's okay, I'm here. I was waving my arms and shouting to them. They couldn't hear me. And I'm like, what is happening? And I was made to understand that I was a spirit now. I had died. And I died through my own sort of carelessness with my health, with my body. And there was no going back. I was on a huge, giant elliptical course that was gradually going to take me further and further out into the darkness. It's hard to explain how devastating it is to have the experience of having died and there's no way back. I've confronted danger many times in combat. I've done things that were scary. I mean, that's all child's play compared to what this felt like. And I was so bereft and anguished that I woke myself up, and we co-sleep as a family, and I woke up right next to my older daughter. Oh my God, I sort of grabbed her, right? Held on to her. Thank God, that was a dream. 36 hours later, that's exactly what happened. I began dying.
That is how Sebastian Junger opens his book, In My Time of Dying, how I came face to face with the idea of an afterlife. And there are a couple of things to say before we hear this conversation. First, Sebastian Junger has a reputation as one of the bravest journalists alive. He spent years embedded with combat units in Afghanistan and other wars. So he's seen a lot of death and a lot of very scary things up close. And second, he's a stoical and unflinching realist. And when a guy like that tells you he had a near-death experience, there's nothing dreamy or floaty about it. His time of dying began on a warm day in June, when Sebastian and his wife went for a walk in the Cape Cod woods, and he had an aneurysm. His pancreatic artery basically exploded.
This is how randomly and casually we die, like in mid-sentence. I felt this flash of pain in my abdomen, and I was like, oh, what is that? And I stood up to sort of like walk it out, and I almost fell over. I didn't know it, but I, in that moment, had turned into a human hourglass. The aneurysm in my pancreatic artery had ruptured. I was losing a pint of blood every 10 or 15 minutes. Jeez. There's 10 pints of blood in your body, and you can afford to lose about half of it before you die. And we're an hour and a half drive away from the nearest hospital.
How'd you even get back? I mean, you're way out in the woods.
Yeah, well, my wife sort of got me an arm around her shoulder, and she sort of half-dragged me, and I half-stumbled out of the woods. You know, it took about 10 minutes. We got to the dirt driveway. She put me in the passenger seat of the car. You know, now I'm really circling the drain, right? I'm starting to go blind. I'm in and out of consciousness. She's like holding my hand, screaming, stay with me, as my eyes roll back into my head. And then a minute later, I sort of come back and I don't know that I'm in and out of consciousness. And there was no cell phone connection. The landline was down because it had been raining. They're old lines. But we eventually got one bar of cell phone connection and called an ambulance. And the ambulance got there, took about half an hour, and doing pretty well all the way to the hospital. And right before we get there, I go off a cliff. I go into end-stage hemorrhagic shock. I start convulsing on the gurney. And I'm, you know, the doctor said probably 10 minutes from dead. So a little bit of traffic, a little bit of this and that. And, you know, I just wouldn't have made it. I mean, shall I continue with my...
Yeah. It's completely okay. Riveting in reading and hearing the story. The thing is, even when you get to the hospital, even when you're, like, as you said, 10 minutes from death, you still didn't think you were dying, right?
No, it never crossed my mind. I mean, I was sort of aware that the stakes were quite high, but I didn't know this was going down right now, right? Like, this is it, your last minutes. So the doctor came up to me. They desperately had to transfuse me because, you know, I was running on fumes. My blood pressure was 60 over 40, and I needed 10 units of blood, which is basically a full oil change. This doctor says to me, I'd like permission to put a large gauge needle through your neck into your jugular.
And, that alone sounds bad.
Oh, right. How wonderful, right? And I'm like, oh, that sounds unpleasant. So I said, why? In case there's an emergency? And he was like, this is the emergency, Mr. Younger, right now. I'm like, all right, if you say so, but I'm not feeling it. I'm, you know, I feel okay. I just, my tummy hurts like that, right? So he starts working on my neck and prepping the neck. And while he's doing that, all of a sudden something happens. Something very, very dramatic happens. I'm aware of this black pit that's opened up underneath me, a kind of vortex that's pulling me in. And the mouth of this pit is directly underneath me, but on the other side of the mouth of this pit, it's infinite. Infinitely black, infinitely huge, and I'm getting pulled into it, into the abyss, right? And I didn't understand. In my fear, suddenly, I don't want to say see, I sense, I perceive my dead father, who was a physicist born in Europe, a rationalist, et cetera, et cetera. I see him appear above me. And he's basically communicating to me, it's okay, you don't have to fight it. You can come with me, I'll take care of you. I was horrified. In my mind, I'm thinking, you're dead. I'm alive. Why would I go with you? Like, I'm just in for belly pain. You got the wrong guy, Dad. You got the wrong moment. We'll talk a lot later. And so I said to the doctor, you got to hurry. You're losing me right now. I'm going. And then I was in and out of clarity and consciousness, you know, for the next 6 hours or so, you know, and I'm in enormous pain. I'm in kidney stone level pain, like childbirth level pain. I'm in absolute agony. At one point, one of the doctors sort of shrugged and said, you know, basically, we tried, didn't work. And the other doctor was like, yeah, it's too bad. Couldn't believe that I was hearing this conversation.
God, you saw that.
Right. And then the first doctor, Dr. Dombrowski, said, why don't we try going through his left wrist? Maybe that's a point of attack in his vascular system that will get us through to the rupture. And the other doctor said, I like the way you think. I remember him saying that. I like the way you think. I was like, oh, to answer your question from 15 minutes ago, that was when I finally understood, oh, I might not survive.
Do you remember it working? Do you remember them...
No.
Anything when you were there, you don't remember them saying, oh my God, we got it, or okay,
no.
Sealing it, nothing like that.
No, no. So I woke up in the ICU the next morning to a voice with a very strong Boston accent, a middle-aged ICU nurse. Good morning, Mr. Younger. Like that kind of accent, right? Like, whoa, where am I? Right. And so I sort of opened my eyes and she said, congratulations. Like you almost died last night. In fact, no one can believe you're alive. It's kind of a miracle. I mean, I was as shocked by that as if someone told you that right now, that you almost died last night. And then I remembered my father, and I remembered the pit. And the nurse left. And I just sat there thinking about having almost died and how my family had almost had to go on without me. And my whole dream almost happens, you know? And what is happening? Like, what's real? Like, I didn't know what real was. I worried that I actually had died in my dream and that everything else was a hallucination. I actually was dead.
Yeah.
So, and you know, I'm vomiting blood. I'm a total mess. I can barely lift my head. Wires everywhere. Like, I still have a needle in my jugular. Like, and the nurse came back and said, "How are you doing, Mr. Younger?" And I said, "Well, I'm okay, but what you told me is terrifying. And I can't stop thinking about it, that I almost died." And she said, "This is a remarkable thing." She said, "Instead of thinking about it like something scary, try thinking about it like something sacred." Now, as an atheist, I sort of like claim the right to understand the word sacred in secular terms as well. It's not just the domain of the faithful. And for me, something sacred information, sacred knowledge, a sacred task is anything that helps people live their lives with more dignity, with less pain, less fear, more love, more connection. Anything that does that is a sacred process. You know, it could be school teachers. It could be therapists. You know, it could be sometimes on our best days, it might even be journalists. Journalists go to these sort of extreme places and come back with information that helps the human race hopefully make better decisions and live better. So I just thought, I've been going to front lines my whole life. And I gave that up, but for some reason, I was sent to the ultimate front line, which is our mortality, my mortality, which is everyone's mortality, like right to the edge of the cliff. I looked over the edge into the darkness, and I was allowed to come back. Like, I was allowed to come back from Afghanistan alive, and from Kosovo and Sierra Leone and Liberia and et cetera. Did I come back with an understanding of life and mortality that might help other people live with more dignity and face their own mortality in maybe more comfortable ways? And so that was the task I set for myself. That was the sense I made of this wise woman's words.
I mean, this question is triggered by the experience of seeing the pit and your dad. Like, you could have gotten close to dying and not seen the pit, not seen your dad. That's what triggers all these questions. And so it seems like as a journalist, you're going to think, what was that? What could explain that? That was your process?
Well, you know, my father was a scientist, and I believe in information as the answer to all things, right? Mm. I mean, I'd say that a little facetiously. So I thought, all right, I can research my way out of this. I'm going to research NDEs, near-death experiences, which are worldwide in every society and, you know, in historical accounts, they're remarkably consistent. It's impossible to say definitively, yes, these NDEs are evidence of an afterlife, or to definitively say they're not. But one of the plausible explanations lies in the realm of quantum physics. And my dad was a physicist. And it comes down to, as a totally legitimate question of science and physics and epistemology, what is consciousness? Because they know at the quantum level that particles act differently depending on if there's a conscious observer or not. And if you don't observe a particle, it's in all places at once. And once you observe it, it's in only one place. And, you know, there's a sort of half-baked idea, which may have some merit, that when we die, we pass from the macroscopic world of conscious observation, where we can only be one thing, you know, in a dying body. Mm-hmm. We pass to the subatomic world where everything is all things.
Right.
I'm not phrasing it well, but something like that.
So it seems like there are a few big things that are just so puzzling and tantalizing about all of this. One is, you can explain away a lot of NDEs by saying, well, it's brain chemistry. You know, we hallucinate at the end of life. But it doesn't explain why so many dying people hallucinate the same thing, their dead loved ones. And that happens over and over again, right?
Right. And this is the part of it that didn't make sense according to the rationalist sort of paradigm. If you give a room full of people LSD, they will all hallucinate. 100% will hallucinate. We know how that works. It's no mystery. But they will not hallucinate the same thing, right? They will not all see purple tigers. And the dying, with incredible consistency, see the dead. The dead appear to collect them. The rationalist explanation for that is it's the dying brain trying to comfort itself in a moment of what otherwise would be terrible terror. But I'm like, no, no, no. I didn't know I was dying. Hmm. And my dad was horrifying to me, right? He wasn't a comfort. He was repulsive to me because I had wanted nothing to do with death. You know, there are many cases, documented cases, of dying people being visited by a person that they're close to who they didn't know had died because the person had died that day or the day before. Like, they didn't know. And then,
really?
Like, they didn't have that knowledge. And they're like, Joe, what are you doing here? And Joe had died in a car accident 6 hours earlier. Like, that kind of weirdness. So that's the one thing that gave me pause and actually pushed me into sort of the quantum realm. Like, the rationalist did not have a good explanation for that.
Does the quantum realm have any kind of explanation for that?
Well, you know, they have a conversation about, well, we don't know how the quantum realm works and what happens to consciousness when we die. And is there a kind of universal consciousness, which, among others, Schrödinger, the physicist, believed in a universal consciousness. A very, very smart people who pioneered quantum physics actually believe in this sort of universalist idea of consciousness. So how would the consciousness of a person who has died fit into that? The illusion of individuality that is our life would cease and would return to the broader reality that it's part of all consciousness and part of, and consciousness is part of all things, of all physical matter. And at that level, time doesn't exist. Everything is everything.
So many of the NDE stories I've heard are euphoric. You know, people see loved ones, and more than that, they feel like, yeah, they're merging with this larger, cosmic, more blissful state. There are stories of people who were really disappointed to wake up here again. You had kind of the dark version.
I sort of don't trust things that make people feel euphoric. Like, you know, on some level as a journalist, I'm like, oh, come on, that's too good to be true. No, but seriously, I didn't die. My heart did not stop. Right? So it's possible, had they been a little slower and had my heart stopped and they'd still somehow managed to resuscitate me and I could have come back with my memories and my visions, that I would have gone from the terror to just an absolutely ecstatic embrace of my father, right? I mean, I talked to one woman who happens to be a friend of mine, a woman in her 70s. She had a car accident. She had a head-on collision of 40 miles an hour with another car going that speed, and it killed her. But it happened right in front of the fire rescue station of this little town where she lived. And the paramedics just came sprinting out with their gear, and her heart stopped, and they paddled her and brought her back. So she has no memory of any of this. She was driving along. The next thing she's aware of, she's running through this beautiful field towards two long dead friends, women she hasn't thought about in decades. And she's like, oh my God, Emily, rushing towards her long dead friends with this joy in her heart. And right before they meet, she's yanked back into this incredibly painful situation. Her body is broken in the wreck of this car. And so there are these ecstatic moments. And maybe that's what would have been coming to me had my heart stopped. You know, I just didn't get far enough.
How do you live with just the giant question mark? Because I think that not knowing what happens after death may be the centrally difficult thing for humans. We can handle believing that there is something, we can handle believing that there is nothing. We have a really hard time handling just not knowing and living with that. What have you learned about how to deal with that?
So it's not that I don't have an explanation. You know, I have several good ones, and I don't know which one is correct. And maybe none of them are correct. Religion being one explanation, like, it can't be tested, so I don't trust it. There's other explanations that sort of can be tested. And to me, the most plausible explanation, if there is something rather than just nothing after death, revolves around the idea of a universal consciousness. Then we sort of rejoin that. And there is something slightly comforting, like, it's all one thing. Don't worry about it.
As journalist Sebastian Younger. His book is called In My Time of Dying, How I Came Face to Face with the Idea of an Afterlife.